This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
There was a virtual World Leaders Summit on climate yesterday, and we just want to take stock of exactly what came out. Different leaders, including our own president, Cyril Ramaphosa, gave commitments at that virtual gathering on matters of climate change mitigation and, you know, just transitions. And this is done under the auspices of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and its Paris Agreement. You know what? It has been a long time. We've been here before. Kyoto Protocol. Negotiate. South Africa, Copenhagen. All these landmark negotiations. And then we arrived at Paris and eventually got that Paris Agreement. What happened when Donald Trump became president? Moved the US out of the Paris Agreement, and that created all sorts of problems in terms of the fight against climate change. It seems as if Joe Biden is trying to move in haste to return confidence that the US is actually taking good action and proposing new measures that may even affect trade insofar as ensuring that countries are part of the climate change discourse. I've got my guest, who is Avina Jacqueline, Climate and Energy Justice Campaign Manager, Groundwork. Good morning, Avina, and welcome to Power Talk.
Good morning, Lacona, and hello to all your listeners.
Thank you very much. I mean, how important, how significant is this virtual World Leaders Summit on Climate Change, which is taking place over the, you know, yesterday and today?
Well, it is a very, very important event, but I think what's far more critical is that we are currently in a climate crisis. Mm. You know, so while President Cyril Ramaphosa says that the country's response to climate change will be guided by, you know, there's a commission that's been set up, a Presidential Coordinating Commission on Climate Change, that will work on a just transition to a low carbon economy and a climate resilient society. There isn't really enough being done to ensure that we are keeping in line with the Paris Agreement. So this obviously aims to keep global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius and less than 1.5 degrees Celsius above industrial temperatures. But the reality is that we are not going to be able to reach those targets.
Yeah.
You know, it seems most likely that, well, it seems highly unlikely that we will keep below the 3 degrees Celsius.
Yes, Avina.
Okay, so I just want to elaborate a little bit more on the nationally determined contribution.
Yes.
You know, each of these countries need to do their bit to ensure that global emissions are reduced, so that we can achieve what they call net zero by 2050, and global emissions need to be reduced by 45% by 2030. We are not on that trajectory at all. And you will see also on the UNFCCC site that we are highly unlikely to achieve these goals. One of the key issues there, and the reason for that, is our continued dependence on fossil fuels. Countries are not held accountable to their contributions and their commitments.
I mean, Avina, we listened and heard from the president of China, Xi Jinping, talking about, you know, they will strive to peak emissions by the end of this decade and reach carbon neutrality by 2060. I mean, how important is that in this fight? Because 2060 seems a long way out, and China and the US account for probably the majority of the emissions around the world.
Yes, the longer we wait, the further we are from reaching our goals. And this is going to increase the climate change impact and leave us in a deeper climate crisis. So, you know, there are other issues at play here, is that as much as we have a new Biden administration with commitments,
yes,
the U.S. has failed to effect change and respond effectively to the climate crisis. This includes pulling out of fossil fuels. They continue with trade relations with China, where China facilitates dirty climate intensive production. And they continue to do so for U.S. markets. So this is going to prevent us from reaching our climate targets. So what's important to remember is that both these countries account for almost half of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. And they need to do far more than just say that they will make commitments. They need to be held to account.
And this is probably what has entirely created an entire skepticism from some smaller nations who feel that this is a stick being wielded by big economies around the world to hit them, to move away from fossil fuels when the big economies themselves don't do the same. You might remember when the Kyoto Protocol was under review, in actual fact, Canada tried to sort of pull out because the commitments they had made in the Kyoto Protocol to reduce emissions had actually not been met. Instead, they had actually increased their emissions at that point in time. I mean, Avina, how do you convince South Africans that this is their problem when the two countries, as you say, accounting for almost half of the emissions around the world, are not moving at the scale that is necessary to dent these climate change, global warming effects that we are seeing in the world?
Yes. Well, there are a few things that need to happen. The one is we have to end our dependency on fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are the primary source of greenhouse gas emissions. And unfortunately, a lot of these northern countries do also invest quite heavily in fossil fuels developments in the south.
Yes.
So South Africa is continuing its reliance on fossil fuels, and it's delaying the shift to renewable energy, which is also, part of the just transition is not only about the transition to cleaner energy, but it is also about changing our society from an unequal to a more equal society. In other words, how do people all have access to affordable and clean energy? Post-COVID, we are now looking at 60% unemployment in our country. And by having expensive energy procurement deals, such as, with car power ships, for example, this is a foreign ship that will be coming in. It's likened to, as Chris Yelland had, I love his description, he calls car power ships, he likens it to hiring an Avis car, that you can hire an Avis car for a trip or a short emergency period, but you cannot hire an Avis car for 20 years and expect that to be affordable for you. So it depends on foreign, employment. It doesn't provide any benefit really to South African communities. It doesn't have much local content. And again, it is burning fossil fuels. LNG, liquefied natural gas, requires a huge amount of energy to cool liquefied natural gas. Then they have to ship this over to a South African port. And then they will be combusting and burning this LNG, again, emitting huge amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. This is not a move towards a low-carbon economy. It is not socially just either. Mm. We need to ask ourselves the question of what sort of energy model do we need in South Africa with such a high unemployment rate and poverty in our country? Can we not look at more socially owned, localized solutions? And do we really need these huge corporatized fossil fuel development?
In fact, Avina, I was talking to one of the partners of the car power ship, and they were, mentioning huge numbers for benefits, something like, 60 million rands per site per year in those communities that they will be for social economic programs. But I asked, who's the host community? And it seems as if that is very difficult to define for a ship floating at sea as to who would you target, who is the most affected, and we we do know what happens where there are emissions. We've seen the Durban South Port, for example, with various problems. People are quite asthmatic and other knock-on effects on people's health standards. How would you say you understand host communities for something like Car Powership, which really is floating at sea?
Car Powership does not fit into the country's striving, you know, to a low carbon economy and a climate resilient society. It is not part of a just transition. It's basically a foreign ship that is dependent on fuel that is purchased in the international market. Nothing is being done locally. We are looking at, take your labor movement, for example. We need to look at, obviously, job creation from a fossil fuels industry moving into a cleaner technologies and cleaner energy. So if we looked at renewables with storage capacity, we can have an establishment of these, you know, as part of the power procurement process in exactly the same time period as what Car Powership would it would take. So if we need to be up and running by July 2022, that is sufficient time for that to take place. We do think that the risk mitigation independent power producers program has been skewed towards gas. And, you know, obviously the tariffs would increase. And I think one of the big issues we are looking at is the cost of this energy to South Africans and the cost to climate. So at the moment, if we look at the price that, you know, Car Powership is being procured at, it's a very, in the next 10, 20 years, we are not sure what we will land up paying for this power because we're dependent on an international LNG source. And also these Car Power ships also run off heavy fuel oil, which are a lot more polluting than LNG. So we don't know that if they do run out of an LNG supply, if they will be given, permission to use heavy fuel oil because it's another emergency. And so we should not be locking ourselves into these dirty fuels and fossil fuels for the next 20 years. It does not give South Africans an opportunity to actually make a proper transition and a change in our energy sector.
We are looking into issues, climate change and energy with Avina Jacqueline. That line is 0861-987-000. If you have a comment or question to pose to her as we reflect on the Virtual World Leaders Summit on climate change this morning. It's a two-day summit involving world leaders from various parts of the world. President Ramaphosa has made a contribution there. He was speaking yesterday afternoon and he really made sure that he commits that when it is given in the form of loan finance, when he was talking about the importance of aid on climate change, that should be provided separately and should not be part of conventional development assistance. As he was saying, when it is given in the form of loan financing, the debt burden of developing countries is worsened. I mean, Avina, there's been a lot of talk around how funding, financing, incentivizing countries to move towards this transition on low carbon economies can be done. Whether, you know, it should be aid, it should be loans. Where are we in understanding the creation of funds that will act as an incentive for countries to transition? Because as you may imagine, with our sense like here in South Africa, with so many coal-fired power stations, we would definitely need some money to create the next infrastructure that we need for low carbon energy emissions.
Yeah, I think there are two important considerations here. The one is, do we need to put ourselves into further debt? Will this mean that we will be carrying further debt in our country? And the second question is, how much are these sort of programs really reaching the poor and the vulnerable and the most affected by climate change? Is that really going to be making a difference? You know, on the one hand, there's a lot of money also that is being spent on what they call natural climate solutions and carbon capture and storage. These are very expensive processes. And if we take natural climate solutions, for example, you know, it assumes that carbon is absorbed by restoring wetlands, forests, and grasslands, and can offset emissions from fossil fuels that are extracted from below the ground. Mm. But the reality is that while the ecosystem restoration is essential, it can only restore what was previously lost by an ecosystem destruction. So trying to take above-ground carbon sinks or trying to compensate for below-ground fossil carbon is considered a fraud. Then with carbon capture and storage, this is an engineering solution which strips carbon from the exhaust gas, from burning fossil fuels and burying it underneath the earth. The big problem here is that this technology is very expensive. It's very energy intensive. It requires massive construction of new infrastructure. And the storage is unproven at the scale that is needed to make any kind of difference. It also depends on very specialized piping and all sorts of things. So, you know, these are the things we need to be aware of, and they must not disguise what is meant to be real solutions for people vulnerable to the impacts of climate change and ecosystems vulnerable to the impacts of climate change with these kinds of false solutions.
Avina, we've spoken, we've had a lot being spoken about this carbon capture and storage and whether or not it might pose other challenges when stored underground. How far is that conversation in us understanding whether there are dangers or not with the storage of you know, these emissions on the ground?
Well, just from a cost perspective, it is extremely expensive. So if it means that you know, there will be R1 billion put towards research and development of this technology, why not redirect those funds into having energy solutions that are less carbon intensive? To me, it just does not make sense that, you know, if we look at the economies, is that if we look at what we can get out of the return of that R1 billion investment, we could have better and cleaner energy and not invest in more fossil fuels and then try to suck up this carbon dioxide from the atmosphere through these very expensive high-tech means that don't actually employ a lot of local people either.
Yeah. In fact, talking about employment of local people, I suppose a conversation on a just transition involves creating domestic capacity to produce much of these what we call independent power producers, to produce much of the inputs and the infrastructure that is needed and not rely, for example, to countries that have had a far greater head start like Germany because of their coal seams having been far deeper underground and making no sense to mine over the years. How do we ensure that we create domestic capacity instead of becoming reliant where energy is concerned from suppliers across the world?
I think, you know, a key part of this just transition is really looking at how we can address these injustices of the past. So even in the U.S., we're looking at the U.S., South Africa, a lot of these countries with fossil fuel developments. For decades, the poor black communities have been forced to live next to toxic, polluting industries. And this has created a deeply entrenched environmental racism. This hasn't been addressed in the U.S. yet. So, you know, they also need to make that transition. The fossil fuels compromise environmental justice. They come with the exploitation of nature and also people in the South. So, you know, communities are also exposed to things like violence, displacement, inequality, and prevents us from achieving this, you know, the zero emissions and a just transition. So if we are to look at addressing the social aspect, why not look at socially owned renewable energy models and invest in that type of infrastructure. So, you know, addressing the injustices of the past means including communities, including workers, including civil society in the decision making. Because at the end of the day, you cannot have an elitist few that make decisions on the behalf of an entire nation and leave them to pay the price.
Absolutely.
So we have to remember, and we've got Freedom Day coming up. We need to remember that we are in a democracy. It's since 1994, our poverty levels have increased. And, you know, what are we really doing to ensure that we are in a democracy, that we're making right and fair decisions about our energy models in South Africa? Are we making the right decisions for our country?
Avina, let me go to 0861-987-000. Offensa, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
No, I'm doing very well. So I'm listening into the call, and you guys are speaking about something very interesting to me.
Yeah.
And the one thing that always touches me is the fact that the reality is China and America are currently the biggest contributors.
Yeah.
Biggest contributors. Yet at this time, when we look at South Africa, South Africa is a developing country / what I would consider a third world. Our biggest concern, especially around poverty, yes, there might be some impact of, I don't want to say emissions, but our biggest impact right now, our biggest struggle is poverty.
Mm.
And poverty, it has no links at this point with climate change. And what I feel sometimes is that our leaders are disingenuous in terms of what they need to focus on. Yes, America and China need to focus on carbon emissions, but Africa as a whole needs to start focusing on poverty and seeing how we start alleviating that. Mm. And I know this is kind of digressing the conversation as a whole, but for me, it's as though, as a country, we know our problems, yet we keep ignoring those problems and we keep putting a different mask on top of that and laying it with loans that my kids won't be able to pay off these loans. I don't know what South Africa would look like 50 years from now, considering that we don't have a climate problem. And speaking to a young African South African, I understand that climate is not a thing for me. It's not.
Okay.
But yeah.
No, I hear you, Offensa. In fact, you're not even dragging the conversation out of the way. You're smack bang correct.
Yes.
Because, Avina, there's always this question, what is the business case for developing countries to actually sacrifice fossil fuels where they've mastered the technologies, the infrastructure, to a new dispensation that is capital extensive in terms of infrastructure rollout?
To be honest, we haven't mastered the technology, because if you look at the World Bank investments into Medupi and Kusile power stations, they haven't produced the amount of energy that they said they would. You know, so no, we're very far from having mastered any kind of fossil fuel.
Well, fair enough, given our load shedding situation.
Yes, right. And then also, the poverty and climate change is very strongly interlinked.
Mm.
And what this means is that the people who will suffer the most from the climate change impact are the poor. You know, the way the climate impacts on how we produce our food, how we have access to energy, all of these things, when there are extreme weather events, when there are droughts, the people that suffer the most are the poor. So poverty and climate change are very closely interrelated.
Mm.
You also have gender. You know, there are myriad of studies that have been done that show that women and children will be the most vulnerable to the effects of climate change.
Mm.
And so, you know, so decisions that will be made around climate change mitigation, about what we are doing to adapt to the effects of climate change, these are the groups that need to be at the core of understanding what the impact will be and to come up with a solution. So you can't make decisions from a top-down approach. You have to include people, because people are the ones that will be impacted. And if you take who will be impacted the most, that's where our solutions need to come from.
Avina, one last question. Questions around, you know, dealing with communities to make sure that they adapt and are resilient to climate change. I don't see much work being done in South Africa as I do in a country like Kenya, for example. Where are we?
Yes. So I have to say that community consultation has become increasingly compromised. And I think particularly now that everybody is going onto the digital platform, it excludes a lot of the communities that do not have access to these. And I don't think that enough is being done to reach out to communities and people on the ground. Mm. If we take the development of the Durban Climate Change Strategy, for example, during the consultation process, and this was before COVID in February last year, you know, the consultants indicated that he didn't actually consult with the communities that would be most impacted in KZN. Those are the communities living close to rivers and the ones in the coastal areas, simply because they had budgetary constraints. So if this is going to be the approach, how do we then allocate funds the actual mitigation of climate change and disaster management when it actually happens? So we have resources, you know, we have access to resources. How do we use this to make sure that everybody is included? And this is also a presidential commitment, is that everybody needs to be included. And so how do we make sure that those things take place? I think government needs to take responsibility for ensuring that they are in dialogue with people.
Avina, let us leave it there this morning, but thank you so much for your time on Power Talk.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Avina Jacqueline, Climate and Energy Justice Campaign Manager, Groundwork. Interesting conversation on climate change, all important for this century.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.